Hey all, this is Craig from Acid Horizon, and I believe it has been a few months since I dropped into the top of an episode and said hello. One of the reasons has been how incredibly busy Will, Adam, and myself have been over the past several weeks and months preparing for the launch of our book, Antioculus, A Philosophy of Escape. Not to mention hosting our reading groups and laying the groundwork for our new series on Zero Books, entitled Zero Horizons. Another reason you haven't heard my voice tearing through the first minute or two of the podcast has been, well, I probably have a disdain for advertising just as strong as yours. Every day I curse those corporate marketing teams of the 1980s and 90s that have burned into my brain a veritably endless playlist of jingles for burger joints and breakfast cereals. I mean, who among us has not been a lifelong host for a tapeworm of semiocapital whose incessant nibbling can be heard even when we retreat into our most quiet thoughts? Well, despite that, I hope you'll allow me a minute or two just to let you know what's going on next year and how you can be a part of it with us. But before I mention those details, let me just say that we are able to offer our podcast without ads for razors or teletherapy because of people like you who subscribe to our Patreon account. Unlike other Patreon creators, we seldom, if ever, create a hard barrier to our audio, videos, or live streams. For example, if you want to join our reading groups or take part in an event, you just DM us or email us at our new website, acidhorizonpodcast.com, and we have a way of making sure you can take part in our events. If, however, you are in a position to support financially, make the investment. Do it for yourself. Do it for us. And do it for the others in the community of listeners and subscribers for whom a subscription might be too onerous at the moment. The important thing is that we work and learn together. Okay, so in 2024, we have a hot list of reading groups. This month, we will finish our Nietzsche and Philosophy reading group with the chapter that features Deleuze's view of Nietzsche's Übermensch. Then in January, we begin Deleuze and Guattari's classic text, What is Philosophy? It's an essential read, really. We'll cover everything from their discussion of the creation of concepts to embodying a politics beyond representative democracy, a perennially important discussion. Once we finish up in the fall, the D&G reading group will then turn towards Deleuze's earlier book on Immanuel Kant, entitled Kant's Critical Philosophy. In January, we also begin the final volume of Bataille's The Accursed Share. And there is also still time to catch up this winter break with Foucault's Madness and Civilization. We will continue reading until May, whereupon we will then begin to tackle Foucault's The Order of Things. What's more, in the spring, by request, by our patrons, many of us will come together for a special reading group on Klossowski's Nietzsche in the Vicious Circle. We ask that you sub at the $5 level for easy access, but as always, we will get you into any of our reading groups if you send us a message. One last thing. We want to thank everyone who has supported us by purchasing Antioculus, A Philosophy of Escape. It was wonderful to meet with folks at our launch events in London, and we look forward to our future event in New York. If you have a copy of our book, you're welcome to join the Antioculus Reading Group, which also begins in January. This is an absolutely free reading group, and of course, no proof of purchase is required. Altogether, that's 5 new reading groups this year. More information is coming soon. For now, just navigate to Acid Horizon's Patreon account and subscribe on the $5 tier. Or hop on the $1 tier, or the $10 tier, or the $25 tier. Acid Horizon and our new publishing venture, Zero Horizons, is a labor of love and our way of fostering a network of serious, like-minded readers on the left. This is what we do, and your support has been absolutely essential to hosting great guests like Catherine Malibu, David Bentley Hart, Stuart Kendall, Alice Capel, Alexander Galloway, and many others. Drop into the show notes now and click the link at the very top. Now you will hear a launch event recording at Tender Books in London this past November featuring Adam with our good friend Billy Cashmore. This engagement was as much for Antioculus as it was for Billy's own book, We Hear Only Ourselves, now out on Zero Books. Together, Adam and Billy put their concepts in conversation as they discuss utopia, epistemology, cybernetics, and more. Okay, let's listen.
So I'm going to read something, then Adam's going to read something. The kind of joke idea that I had and sort of attempted to impose on Adam by fiat was that I was going to answer. There was never going to be an answer, so it was only going to be responses. But I decided that would be mad. I'm going to read something. I'm going to read the conclusion. We're actually both going to read conclusions, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm going to read the conclusion to We Hear Only Ourselves, which isn't very long. And Adam's going to read the conclusion to Antiochus. And I think it's me first. Oscar,
yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, so this is the political afterword, which I wrote after writing the rest of the text, as a kind of attempt to make this book say something that wasn't just about Adorno. The subtitle is the epigraph for Julian Rose's Love's Work, which is Keep Your Mind in Hell and Despair Not. Okay. So there is a well-rehearsed demand on philosophy that it be effective. In the words of those granting funding for research, this is often understood as demanding that a work have impact. This is really the reflection of the idea that a work of philosophy must be comprehensible, the view that I rejected in the foreword, which reduces a work to the extent to which it is already subsumed by actuality. If a work is judged primarily on its impact, then the work is reduced to the extent to which it can already work within our actuality. This would be the destruction not only of philosophy, but also of radicalism itself. One of the conclusions of my argument here is that utopian thought must remain steadfastly committed to its non-enclosure by whatever it is that it is trying to escape. I've also shown that such an escape will always be illusory, but it is this expression of the impossibility of a moment of escape that shows our actuality itself to be an illusion. But this means still that philosophy must not give up on itself, nor give up on utopia, and thus reduce itself to mere practical impact. There is, however, an accompanying demand, equally inescapable, that all this writing be something more than a game for those with postgraduate degrees to admire or disdain. There has to be something more than dialectical jousting, though I accept that statement is mostly one of hope. Indeed, philosophy is nothing at all if it understands itself as totally without political import. Philosophy is always a product of politics. So even philosophy which puts on a pretense of political abstention is always, and in that case especially, involved. As such, though the explanation of the practicality of philosophy is to an extent a momentary suspension of the philosophical, it must be part of a philosophy lest it retreat into ideological speculation. No one wants to know how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. So let me say this. Herbert Marcuse, in his political preface to Eros and Civilization, also written after the rest of the book, argues that the conditions under which those in the global north now live are, quote, transforming the earth into hell. But this hell is concentrated in places far away from the eyes of the citizens of Beverly Hills, Mayfair, and Monaco. It is those infernal places that illuminate the whole. I'm uneasy about at least one aspect of Marcuse's argument here, namely the invocation that the radical action of people of colour against colonialism and racial capitalism will do what white Westerners are too comfortable to bother with. That said, I will say that the inferno illuminates the whole. Those ways of life condemned to non-redemption that are there primarily to be cured are the inferno that will at first shine light upon the whole before setting it ablaze. Utopian narrative can be constructed, therefore, in the articulation of these infernal identities, whose break with actuality will always be a falsehood and will show the whole to be false. Indeed, the point of such an inferno is not to hold up those identities as what is there to be affirmed, what it is there that we could say yes to. The thought of utopia tells us that we do not live in the right world. We will not find liberation by excavating through the wreckage of history or in lost futures, no matter how hard we look. Utopia is not in history. It is not anywhere. Inferno illuminates the whole not because a revolutionary identity will emerge from its flames that will finally be the one to affirm. There is no redeeming a detention centre. There is no redeeming a prison. There is no redeeming Gaza. But in hell, identity is at its most false, and as such, at its most utopian. So just as this afterword has to appear as a separate to philosophical analysis, so politics will always, for a moment, present itself as a break with the social. Politics must always deny its comprehension from the point of view of the whole, and so denies its comprehension under the philosophical. Infernal identities are created by the machines of death and only secure their utopian quality by their negative relation to actuality. When one presents as outside of some system, outside of the wage relation and structures of mutual aid, outside of gender and non-binary expression, in fugitive defiance of race as a determining force, all of those are false, but they are no more false than what is given. It's hard work to maintain an illusion. The machines of death know this. So we infernals must work harder. Keeping up the apparition of the non-actual within actuality is a battle. And like other battles, this one will be won by an organized mass. Leaning too far into a strategy of individuality, believing that by making oneself smaller or even imperceptible, one will be less easily engulfed by the rest of actuality is always a mistake. We are always just as much part of actuality. The illusion will only ever be maintained with collective support. Still, this is not a battle that can be won in the open, but it can be won by a guerrilla infernality that knows hell better than its enemy. It must stay out of sight, and when it is seen, it will never appear as itself, since it never can. At each moment, the enemy will try to find truth in Inferno's flames. It will look for something to affirm. But Inferno's strength is in never letting them know what it is, because it cannot be. Radical politics can only occur as the suspension of what is. Utopian narrative articulates an impossibility, the non-actual within the actual. This is why radical politics must cling to utopia. We must not fall into the defence of an identity absolutely opposed to the machines of death that will, in the last instance, become a part of the machine we seek to oppose. Nor can we condemn these as mere falsehoods in comparison to a more real, more material struggle. Of course we live in the false. Falsehood is all there is. Utopian narrative articulates the necessity of the non-actual within the actual, dissolving the actual with a solution of its own creation. Mark Fisher writes that for now our desire is nameless, in hoping for a label to attribute to the political movement that would come in the 21st century and truly break with the 20th. He is right that whatever organises our politics is nameless, but wrong that it will have a name, or indeed could ever be named. The name of utopia is nothing, and nothing cannot be said. Our politics is the falsehood of all naming, of all actuality. It will not be found in a heaven, and we ought not hope for a desire to save us. It is not coming. Utopia is found only in hell, so we must live there. Nothing can save us now.
Steve, concluding uncybernetic postscript to Antioculus called What is Philosophy? And luckily, the last chapter also, before this, also ends with an image of hellfire. So, the image of hell, at first glance, appears to be an unwelcome visitor to the discussion of psychosocial machines. Nonetheless, the machinic economy of the image and of the unconscious, in being determined by the capitalist process, tends towards an infinite and unyielding drive for accumulation and production. The law of value has instituted itself in the world system as its imperial axiom, with the help of many of the machineries that we have taken great pains to describe. It has achieved a perfect isomorphism with that legal institution that, according to dominant trends in Christian theology, quote, knows neither interruption nor end, hell. The image of hell is isomorphic, that is, translatable in form and function, to the principle of the world system. Such an image of eternal hellfire is nonetheless not an ahistorical image, but an image whose popularity has bloomed under a Calvinist, capitalist unconscious, centered on an eternally decreed and unyielding debt. Namely, the debt of systems to perpetually correct their course in infinite gatherings of feedback and data, and the debts that capital owes to itself, the imperative to always be more of itself, to capitalize upon itself. One does not escape hell by redemption, itself an economic transaction, but through a rendering inoperative of the infernal economy. The question is not, in a sense, what is to be done, but how is it to be done? It is a matter of tactics in relation to an understanding of the enemy's machinery and their politics of strategic oversight. Whether it is Macindale in Haiti, the George Floyd rebellion, the Tool prison rioters, the resistance of groups like ADAPT, or Marguerite Perret's silence for her inquisitor, each provides an exemplar of a manoeuvre of escape, withdrawal made in order to make possible a means of counterattack. The withdrawal that makes new becomings possible, which is also an assault on what is, that is what we mean when we say creative involution. Withdrawal is nonetheless a matter of degree in our increasingly cybernated world, with capture around every corner and a precarious working life ever more common. It seems impossible to embrace the kinds of fugitivity of a Macindale, nor can we all withdraw into the manner of the popular image of escaping the cities to rural homesteads. Nonetheless, what is to be withdrawn from is the ceaseless motion and flow of capitalist production and cybernetic governance. One can withdraw from within, much like the creative involution of an organ. It is only in the secrecy of tactical moments of withdrawal within the systems that we can find each other, at the pub, at a union meeting, or in a conspiratorial space. The first task is theorizing, then strategizing. We do not believe we have communicated any kind of totality of machines in this book, and what we call the cyber scene may yet bequeath to us more horrors. Nonetheless, we have presented machines that operate as the apparatuses which determine so many contours of our current inferno. At this point, it may be expected that we will make the typical gesture of a denunciation of philosophy as a kind of pseudo-activity. We philosophers have only interpreted the world system, but it is up to you, the people, capital T, capital P, to change it. No, this platitude suggests a distance that philosophy constantly occupies and which we categorically refuse. As we assert in the beginning, we assert at the end. Every text, and therefore every philosophy, is a machine, always involved the community it establishes of its audience, and the theoretical and political desires that connect the two. Philosophy cannot stand attached from the world, and any claim that it could is a false pretense that only functions to detach it from its own collaboration with the world as it currently is. Philosophy is the creation of concepts in a manner hostile to the order of things, or it is mere collaboration with it.
Right. So I think I'm going to ask some questions, right? And then you can come back. Yeah. One of the most interesting things about this book is the title. Mm. Save the kind of the reference to Deleuze and Guattari.
Yeah.
I'm interested in anti, and thus also in Deleuze and Guattari, and the status of negativity in general in this book, whether in its kind of purely logical mode, as negation, or in its kind of political appearance as resistance, as your conception of resistance. And I wonder, in what sense this negation or refuse, and when it appears as refusal, genuinely refuses what it says. And my question is really, to what extent does this mode of negation, which is basically Althusserian, it's the understanding of negation as the result of non-antagonistic contradictions in the kind of reading of, in the French reading of Mao, right? So it's, there's no sense in which this contradiction involves its opposite. It's just, you know, those are problems of thought that you've kind of appear to have moved beyond via strategy. And I wonder to what extent this negation accepts the terms of what is given and thus retains an element of the given.
It retains the terms of the given insofar as it doesn't give the given its due in the sense of, you know, the systems of cybernetic capture and control really capture what they capture. Because the theory, so the anti here, typically in dialectical thinking, an example I give to explain dialectics, the magnet, you know, a magnet isn't just the identity of, you know, if you figure, what is a magnet? Okay, it's a negative pole and a positive pole. Okay, well, you've literally, in your thought, you've done what Hegel calls the moment of understanding. You've cut the magnet in half. Now, what happens if you cut a magnet in half? You get two magnets, because the identity of the poles is only consistent in the opposition between the positive and the negative. They're mutually interdependent. And there's a constant sort of refrain with dialectics here of, you can't be against anything, because to be against it is to accept it and then posit yourself against it. My response to that is, there's a different, ultimately, that even if you may see, you can't be against this thing, that means you're defining yourself against it. Well, that the first thing doesn't actually capture everything about the thing that's resisting. Example you have ocularity. The ocularity, the main sort of concept of the book, Anti-Oculus, you know, is about finding where attempts at recognizing insurgent forces are not a problem with those insurgent forces themselves, but the systems that try to counter them. So, for example, the example I give is the Haitian Revolution, and Hegel particularly is reading of his racial thinking, because whilst for the slave owners in Haiti, the slaves, it would be absurd for a dietitian to say, why are you trying to negate your own position? That will negate yourself. Like, yeah, you want to fucking negate ourselves. That's the entire Marxist point of it. But in terms of the idea of something that escapes being captured within a dialectical boundary of, if you negate something, you're therefore beholden to it. In the eye of the slave master, the people revolting were, you know, contained by satanic forces. I mean, it was just satanic babbling, which was actually for them the practice of obey a religion and the spiritual traditions that they carried with them. Because the people on those boats were not blank slates, as liberal ideology from Locke onwards said. They had ideas, and they still do, and they still proliferate. And if anything, the diffusing of negativity is more in the eye of the person who proclaimed the dialectic in that sort of traditional sense of, you can't negate anything about being beholden to it. And in that sense, the anti is to say, it's not a philosophy of escape as there is a new kind of escape, it's that the capture presupposes escape. The dialectic presupposes what's outside of it as its kind of, to use a term from Schelling, its dark ground. I mean, it's the same reason that I think even in your book, that, you know, the precondition of comprehensible philosophy is the issue of incomprehensibility, which still exceeds it.
I mean, but I think that's really interesting. I think that is exactly the point. I mean, say your reading of Haiti, which I don't think is C.L.R. James's.
It's Robinson's.
It might be Robinson's, but that would be... My claim isn't that you can't escape things, really. My point is that you have. So I think in some ways you might like to think of this as my critique. You know, if I didn't think that you could escape anything, I wouldn't be doing anything, right? I'd just be a nihilist. But my point is that you're still writing a book and you're still in thought. And my question, I mean, I suppose there's a real kind of dangerous charge here, which is that by thinking that there's something genuinely outside of it, there's a kind of sphere of action of escape, which is genuinely outside of, say, cybernetic capture or what else, you're essentially, you know, you're in danger of re-importing as something that looks quite a lot like an Enlightenment subject that is sort of free from any external determination and has worked out for itself what it is, right? And the kind of the Spivakian point, which I think is just the same as the Marxist one, is that there is nothing other than the comprehension of falsity. And now that can really affect your action in important ways which are non-philosophical, right? That that might affect genuine action. And that's sort of the point of one of the aspects of narrative in We Hear Only Ourselves. But to think that, I mean, you think that capture always presupposes escape.
Mm.
My point is that escape also always presupposes capture. And you've only seen one way in which this is going. But because insofar as everything that escapes is always conceived as that which escapes by what is captured, it's why you have to write this text from the point of view of the ocularity of company.
I think this is why we're so interested in reviving the somewhat trivial notion of accelerationism, which is a trivial notion. Acceleration is what if my lads were faster than the other lads? But there is a moment of contingency, and it doesn't matter if it's historicity to this, in which yes, escape presupposes capture, absolutely.
Mm.
But nonetheless, I do think it presupposes. I take myself back a little bit. I'm still sympathetic to the Bataille idea that it's the negative, the dark elements that structures the boundary between the two.
Mm.
Like it's the abnormality, particularity of a body which structures the division between the abnormal and normal.
Mm.
And I think that is a preceding activity, even going from someone like Bataille, the big toe is how we stand up, and it's sort of his idea of, it structures the division between the two. And to some extent, in terms of the presuppositions, yes, but you can kill presuppositions. I mean, you can destroy presuppositions to some extent. In terms of,
someone's been trying that for a long time. I don't think they've managed it yet.
We haven't killed Kant yet. But I think that is why strategy has to come into it, honestly, because loss escape does presuppose capture in the same way that capture presupposes escape.
Mm.
It is a matter of essentially gaining the upper hand, because insofar as what escapes, I mean, there's what escapes as rendered by that which captures, and there's that which escapes as essentially rendered by the limits of capture. So the limits of the slave master's vision and understanding of its subject is the limit of his counterinsurgency.
Mm-hmm.
From the standpoint of counterinsurgent strategy, you can only good example. You can the Israeli military has the most cybernetically enhanced data capture system on the planet. If only they didn't give it to someone else who wasn't, just a complete genocidal, fropping in the mouth, racist, then they would be able to use it, wouldn't they? But they can't. The data's only as good as the people that program them, and their life determines their consciousness, not vice versa. And so there's a risk there of, by saying, aren't you really captured by presupposing a thing, it just ends up being there is ultimately no escape other than the false. But recognizing the falsity of yourself being rendered intelligible as data, as normal, as this version of racialized subject, I think there's a kind of resonance there between our two works, particularly on the level of recognizing this as false. But just not, I think there's the tension between our two works in terms of, can you still speak of it? Because sometimes I think utopia, it's only narrative that saves it from the theme of narrative in your book that takes it from moving into, this Wittgensteinian thing of whereas one cannot speak, one must therefore be silent. And then it almost ends up utopia as an idea becomes a regulating ideal, almost like a negative feedback mechanism. It's like, here's how we conduct our narrative of what the world's going to be like, on the premise that as soon as utopia becomes that, utopia, to quote Stuart Lee, dissolves upon contact with air. And therefore, as soon as you say it, it almost feels like sometimes in your work you have to be a bit like Abraham in Kierkegaard's Fear and Trembling, where we have this solemn divine task of absolute duty. But as soon as we say it, it's in generality, we can't defend it in the realm of discourse. And so it's almost like we have to be silent utopians.
Oh, I don't think so, although the silence there is really interesting. Mm. Given the importance of sound, so I think that is my worry, right? And if you're right, then the book does fail. But I don't think you are right in your reading. And the reason I don't think that you're right is because you think that when I say that utopian thought is necessarily contradictory, that's a criticism. My point is actually that utopia is the most contradictory idea, and that's why it's so good.
Mm.
And my point is that utopian narrative can offer a kind of response to that. It doesn't answer it in the sense that, you know, you give an answer to some equation, you know, or what's really going on. It's a kind of poetic response, that the idea being that in its, so narrative is defined by Paul Ricoeur, which is the guy who's, this all comes from, is mimesis of human action. That is to say, it appears as if these things were done. So if you read The Great Gatsby, right, it looks like this, you know, it appears like something's actually happened. Similarly for history, right? You can read as many histories of the Haitian Revolution as you like, but you're not too soft. And the point is that the third mimesis, and there are three, is that is the refiguration of your experience, which is to say, which might therefore open up possibilities in the future. So my point is that for speculative thought, there is an escape. But for narrative, there is. Or at least for narrative, there is an expression of escape. And the reason why that's important is because I don't think there's an escape, but I think there's resistance. Whereas for you, resistance and escape are basically equivalent.
Yes.
Yeah. You go.
Well, we say the philosophy of escape is not escape because we don't put that much. We put a lot of weight, more weight in philosophy than certain philosophers might want to. But we don't think, I mean, this is the, like, the debate of being a podcaster. Some people think you are, I mean, people buy, you know, the Chapo Guide to Revolution. No shade on Chapo, of course. But, like, we didn't want to write, you know, here's a manifesto of these guys who live in your phone who are going to tell you how to do revolution. We know that there are limits of certain strategies of policing. We can analyze policing and essentially provide a counterinsurgency manual. We're not going to underrate philosophy in the quietest way of an analytic sort of tradition, but we're not going to overrate it. I
mean, yeah.
If the philosophy of escape itself was escape, we would have done that by now.
Yeah, no, exactly.
I mean, there's so many, like, failures of escape, particularly in the sorts of things we look at. I mean, the cybernetic communes. I mean, I said this at the last event. The cybernetic communes of the 70s, where everyone was going to, you know, go out to the countryside, buy some land. I mean, Black Hammer famously did this. I probably shouldn't have mentioned it on record. They're a weird cult. But, yeah, their thing was, let's all go to the provinces. Let's all buy some land and then, you know, make a commune there.
Yeah.
And that's just white flight, but from the left. That's taking away the demographic of middle-class people that can up and go. And taking away the people that can afford bail, that can pay to go and fund these, and fucking won't get hit by the cops usually because they don't look like the very people the cops are most hostile towards. And so the fear of escape we've got here is not a fear of getting to the outside, you know, the thing that Land was talking about. More is it how there's actually a non-philosophical presupposition hidden within the philosophy of capture, which is why the elaboration of philosophy of capture to its limits, and this is a Hegel point, you know, if you reach a boundary, you're already some way on the other side of it, provides a philosophy of escape.
So I think perhaps there's a really telling example, which I'm... No. But I just want to... Oh, where is it you talk about Mark Duggan?
The Ultimates.
Yeah, exactly. This is highly professional, as you can tell.
That list is incomplete, by the way.
It is incomplete. Two
people check through a book. That's very
fun. Yeah, that's really fun. Yeah. Well, okay. Well,
there we go.
That's why I don't
pay for it.
Thank you very much. So he writes about this ultimate. So the ultimate human, the last person to be murdered by a system which triggers an acceleration into active revolt, is an entity that power struggles. The power struggles to quantitatively define. Systems of information regularly only pick it up when it's too late. George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Rodney King, Mark Duggan, Mahsa Amini, Breonna Gay, to name but a few. These were the ultimates, the final bodies coated in hot blood before this heat crossed the threshold. Now, what I want to know is there is one name that is conspicuously absent there because, I mean, one name at least there, Breonna Gay, right, there hasn't been. The name that's conspicuously absent there is Emmett Till, which is interestingly the only reason that it was absent conspicuous to me is because that's the only example I give of utopian narrative in the whole world. Right, so the last page is the example of the Emmett Till photograph. So there is an example of utopian narrative, which is the photograph taken of Emmett Till, which has this quality that Fred Moten describes of being, you literally can't look at it, right? It's like the most horrible thing you could possibly look at, but yet it also demands to be looked at. And in its kind of like, in that kind of contradictory action is reflected, I think. So you have to look at it in light of, you know, a feeling that I should look at this for, you know, because I think that this will create some kind of reckoning of action. But similarly, you cannot look at it, not just for the violence that it depicts, but for the violence that it remembers. Because, of course, the point of that photograph and the reason that Mamie Till demanded that the photograph, that the funeral be open casted, demanded that they'd be on the front page of the New York Times, was because she thought that it would, you know, make obvious a kind of history of violence. And in that case, it's precisely something which looks quite a lot like it's the narrativization. Had Mamie Till not done that, it doesn't, you know, you could have done that a number of more times. The reason why George Floyd's murder, I think, perhaps, you know, gave rise to the action that it did was not just because it was one more murdered person, but because of the specific, the videos, the theatrics of that horrible video, had, it's a matter of quality here, not of quantity. And so for me, that's why narrative is so important for my book in some senses, because I think the narrative really has a relation to action in a way that data doesn't.
It's the issue of doing it from the standpoint, not to control systems themselves.
Yeah.
Insofar as we're trying to find a limit to them, they don't. When they do narrative in the sense of they try to render someone who they kill as a sacrifice for the whole of the equation. Thank you. So an example I give is Nancy Pelosi. She says, thank you, George Floyd, for sacrificing yourself for our country. I mean, it was such a disgusting thing that I accidentally wrote the wrong spelling of the word wretched in the book. there is that tension of rendering things in light of the apparatus, which I think was definitely harder in part the second chapter of the book. The third chapter is easier because the manual written for the apparatus, written from a standpoint of people who are against them, as if they were for them. But the Emmett Till example is, I mean, that's there is no narrativization of it. It does cut off a narrativization and is resting on a certain kind of, it's retrospective, and that the last person there was before there was a revolt. And of course, there is a myth in there, and that there was, of course, strong protests. I mean, I went to one in Soho, down the road, a small vigil, and there was a protest for that. But that's the problem with presenting apparatuses. You end up sort of missing them in the same way that they do. But regarding the Till photo, I mean, why is it narrative utopia of Emmett Till?
Right. Okay. Good.
It does show the falsity of the entire world, because if this world produces this, then it's not worth having.
Well, there's that. There's certainly the moral thing, but the reason why I think it's so. Perhaps I could just read it. So. My problem in the last chapter is exactly what we've been talking about, going back and forth about for about the last 20 minutes, which is this question of the engulfment of what ought to be by what is, essentially. Yeah. Right, and my point is that that's a genuine aporia, and I'm not accusing you of accident, if you know, being a fool and being caught up in this contradiction. The point is that I am too. And so I think that the photograph of Emmett Till responds to that aporia in a narrative mode. So the photograph is prefigured by the history of racial violence and domination that led to Till's death, and is thus prefigured by the scream of a slave, Aunt Hester's specifically, I think, which is Frederick Douglass's aunt in his narrative, slave narrative. However, as I have already shown, since this domination always requires the resistance that opposes it, the prefiguration by a tradition of continuity is always accompanied by a ruptural tradition of resistance. The aporia that this chapter has been concerned with is really a configurative one, which essentially argues that because the taking of the photograph itself narrates the resistance, which wouldn't be possible without the domination, and equally the domination would be possible without the resistance. And so, it's the demand to look at it is the demand, is the debt that you have to Emmett Till for not taking action previously, right? Mm. Because essentially, you know, the death of everyone in history indicts the now for not having redeemed them, right? That's the... Now, I obviously don't think that redemption is possible within actuality, which is why hell is so important. But that doesn't mean that the demand for redemption is not placed upon us. And so I think that there's a continual economy of debt, which, you know, as I said, you know, it's the most upsetting thing I can say to a Nietzschean.
It's utopian
because its demand is impossible but also necessary.
Where our demands are most modest, we only want the earth. Is that James Carney?
Is it this
impossibility which sticks to me, because it's the way we talk, because your book is about narrative, more about knowledge, I know, but I think the two, everything sort of melts into Kant, you know. Does utopia end up being a regulative principle then of narrativizing itself?
No, because a principle is epistemological and utopia isn't. So a principle, right, would be something like which affects the way that you could correctly apply this. So I could say to you, don't, you know, if you want to know how to apply the category of causation, you've got to look for some event which always presupposes, which is always followed by some cause, right? That's Kant's principle of causation. Right? That's what we mean. And then there might be a regulative ideal, which is something that you can't really believe in, but you have to sort of have an image of, so that you have any knowledge. So something like the whole of the universe, right? You sort of have to believe that everything's connected, but you can't actually think about the whole universe, right? That's the Kant's point, right? But all of that... So I don't think that anything that I have said in this book makes the speculative thought of utopia any less contradictory. I'm not trying to find a concept that is going to do what Kant thinks a regulative ideal does, which is steer the course nicely so that you don't say, you know, make a fool of yourself rather, you know, at the philosophy conference. which I tend to do. But the point of the narrative is not to make you think about things better, but to make you act. I don't know whether narrative is a kind of thought. It's a mimesis of action, though. Maybe it is, but perhaps that's not the point. It's certainly not about the application of a concept or something like that. And so the reason, so insofar as the question of whether this, you're meant to know anything as a result of this, I don't really care. You might know more about the history of utopia. But in terms of what effect it's actually meant to have on you, it's meant to have an effect of action, or it's meant to have an effect on your experience, which, so I suppose it's a more phenomenological consequence in the weak sense of just like what stuff feels like, rather than the production of a new knowledge or something like that. It might not be satisfying.
Part of the negative aspect, the most pessimistic aspect of anything we do on cybernetics is understanding the way that people can endure a constant exposure to the narrative of how evil this world is.
But the utopian narrative doesn't think the whole world is evil.
Because it's wrong.
Which is different. But that's different, isn't it? Because it's only wrong because evil is being done. But it's the tradition of resistance which is narratified, right? The tradition of the press is the same thing as the tradition of resistance. Even on your accounts, given the kind of presupposition of domination by resistance. I mean, unless you really, really want to follow up, I have a question about the cyber. I have a question about cybernetics, which is a slight change of course, but I feel like we could probably go back and forth on that and not get anywhere. But I am confused and have always been confused about cybernetics because when people talk about it, actually, you explain what cybernetics is really briefly before I ask you a question about it.
Right, so cybernetics is a buzzword invented by the CIA. No, that's actually true. It comes mostly the term out of the Macy's conferences funded by the CIA and USS in the 40s. But there's about 20 different definitions. The definition given by the founder of science, Norbert Wiener, is the science of control and communication in the animal and machine. There are really 3 to 4 different main concepts, which is, the main concept is feedback, positive and negative. Positive feedback is what we know as a vicious circle. You infect someone with a disease, then suddenly 40, then 60, then 80. You know, things spiral out of control. They go too far in the direction the system's already going in. The system is infectious, it goes more infectious. Negative feedback is more like thermostats or negative regulation. You want to move, you know, thermostat has to keep it 10 degrees, keep generating heat, and then turning the heating off periodically so that it stays at a stable level, similar to blood sugar levels in diabetics. They have these machines, their phone, it'll go, okay, you need to eat some sugar. Your blood sugar's gone to this level. You eat something, there's a system of information that changes the behavior of a system. It tells you when to intervene in the behavior of a system. And then the thing that we mostly focus on in this book is called feed forward, which is when you try to preempt error before it happens. Problem is that how do your feed forward systems learn anything? Things learn through things going wrong. So rather than thinking about purely feed forward, we think about feed forward systems that learn through negative feedback, the ways historically governmental techniques have developed.
So cybernetics is a study of all of those things, right? Which is important, and to an extent, also a theory. This is the thing. It's also a metaphysics, isn't it?
It's an epistemology.
You also think that these things are really feedback systems, right? You're making a claim about what is out there. So in a week, if you want to call it social ontology, you can call it social ontology, but it's still metaphysics. And it's... But it also appears, so you get that sense of the cyber realm in cybernetics, but you also have the sense of the cyberpunk present, which is a historically diagnostic category. And so my question is, those two seem to be rather in tension, because the former seems to adopt a kind of a position outside of history in favour of a kind of presentist synchrony of data. Right, again, kind of Althusserian, where they're kind of thermostatic, not thermodynamic, interestingly, systems. And then the other is that cybernetics is just a tool whose purpose is defined by the specific historical task that we're now in, by virtue of, for example, the fact that capitalism might have turned primarily towards data as its mode of extraction rather than labour power. And that seems to me... So would you be making the claims, perhaps this is a point, about the transcendental status of cybernetics at a different point in the history of capitalism? Because this is the problem with cybernetic theories of capital, is because they're actually always historically specific.
Yes.
But in order to be theory of capital, they have to be more historically general.
This is the problem you adopt a cybernetic mode of reasoning that retrospectively renders anything which looks back upon itself or is recursive or even interdependent something that it can render in cybernetic terms. It spreads like a virus. This is why it turns so many cyber theorists, Mr. Land in particular, into batshit idiots. I don't think there's a synchronicity of data, synchronic nature of data here.
Yeah.
Insofar as we're talking about apparatuses, cybernetically, they are always historically determined and developed historically through feedback loops, and they're rendered in that way insofar as we can find an abstract diagram of them. By diagram, I mean like a flow chart, different relations in relation to anything that flows through these stations. And in that sense, you want to provide not so transhistorical, but abstract it enough so that we can provide examples of if these functional relations are the same, here are their limits.
Right.
And in terms of...
Can I ask you about limit? What do you mean by that? Do you mean like a boundary or do you mean like a tendency?
When I say limit of a cybernetic, what I mean is in terms of the limit of what is intelligible to it, such the limits of a category, what can we unsay? So Kant's philosophy can be summed up in one sentence. We only receive in our experience what is receivable to our capacity to receive it.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else is noise, signal versus noise.
Mm-hmm.
And we want to provide the limit of, because every signal comes with noise. And sometimes noise itself can be made into a signal. You can make a burst of white noise. 4-4, there we go, done. It's basically about finding out distinctions, essentially.
Yeah.
Finding that noise which signals freedom, as Bowden put it.
And yeah.
In terms of cyberpunk versus cybernetics, I think cyberpunk is defined by high-tech, low-life. And we have an incredibly high-tech life, incredibly low life, in the sense of life is abundant but treated absolutely terribly. I mean, the reason why cyberpunk fiction is so important to us, or to me particularly, I guess, is that most cyberpunk is about healthcare. Neuromancer is about a man who his nervous system is fried, and he gets it back based on the condition that he's got these poison capsules in his body, which if you don't do what this guy tells you to do, he's going to burst them, and you're not going to be able to have this extension of your senses, your body, into cyberspace. Or even that personal example. So my mum's a type 1 diabetic.
Mm.
She has a insulin regulatory system. That is, I taught her cybernetics through that. You know, so
yeah.
And so these ideas we had of cyberpunk of these, it's this amazing like implanted organs.
Mm.
The same diagram could draw of a sensor that picks up data from your body and uses that to regulate your activity to optimize it. That's the same thing, of course. You know, we don't need implants. We have explants. So it's called institutions. So that's what the NHS is. I mean, that's what the battle, of course. I mean, you know, the battle for healthcare and is a battle over regulation. And so I think the cyberpunk present. If anyone came past Tottenham Court Road, that monstrosity outer net, you know, it's not just aesthetically, but also in terms of the regulatory systems, it is very cybernetic, particularly in the sense of who's allowed to be sacrificed in part of the diagram of social relations. I mean, people thought the pandemic was, you know, out of control. It was very, not in control in the sense of someone's, you know, like, oh, we're going to let these people die. You know, it's like Dominic Cummings is like, we're going to make these guys, they're all off, but rather there are habits of governance.
Mm. So for you, could you explain the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution in cybernetic terms?
Not right now, but however.
But in principle. Is that something that you think, because that's my question, is whether cybernetics is a recent invention.
Mm.
Metaphysically speaking, or whether it's the correct way of understanding the world that we've only recently discovered.
If it was correct to understand the world, we wouldn't have wrote the book. If it was correct to understand the world,
the way that societies function.
I think it's good enough. It's good enough to know how to kill societies. It's good enough to go on the attack. It's fine. But this book is not a book of cyber theory in the sense it's on like Baudrillard's. You know,
right.
The map precedes a territory.
Yeah.
We draw in the war on a map territory distinction on the side of that distinction.
Yeah.
You know, because the violence of the map is the violence of imperialism.
Sure.
And the violence of abstract world. But abstraction presupposes escape, and the escape presupposes abstraction. That's our thesis.
Yeah.
If cybernetics was the correct way to view the world, we would be, you know, No shade, of course. So, you know, Alex Williams, Nick Cernicek.
Yeah.
I mean, Paul Mason.
Don't say more times.
I'm already on the list, I'm guessing. So.
So, I mean, I think we've spoken quite a lot about the disagreements or the divergences between the two books. So, I think that Antioculus is a genuinely invaluable from the standpoint of understanding the modes of domination which typify the present moment. That is all true despite my conceptual reservations. But what I'm interested in is to what extent you think that there's a shared project between these two books, given that, you know, philosophically they actually have few. I did do a cursory check to see how many citations were in common. They were like none, genuinely. I think Marx was in both.
Yeah, there we go.
That was basically it. There were none, and Fitchin's there. But you know, we both just went past. So what extent is there anything we share other than the kitchen sink.
we both agree that most if not all identification is wrong.
Right.
And is kind of produced. But that doesn't mean that to have an identity is, you've been duped, you've bought into having an identity. It's more that, it's not the be all and end all. I think the main point of disagreement really is on how much we want to use the Black Panthers, because
you're going to do this quite to me.
You spend a lot of time trying to break Henry P. Newton out of his Nietzschean spell in favour of Moton. I mean, there's a quote from Nietzsche from the Uncanny Annotation, which I gleefully extracted from Deleuze's Nietzschean philosophy.
Which essay is it?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I got it from Deleuze. So Deleuze is the first three words, which is thinking actively is, and then Nietzsche, acting in a non-present fashion, therefore against time and even on time, in favour, I hope, of a time to come. Yeah. And I'm still very sympathetic to someone like Howard Cagle's work, also Sprach Zapata, that when we think about a left Nietzscheanism, and I'm not a left Nietzschean, but
it's quite
I can still teach Hegel, so I'm not going to let Nietzscheanism. But I'm not a left Nietzschean. What is it? The eternal recurrence is resistance, I still believe. I mean, what is it that Moton does for you that Newton can't, the theory of the will to power, essentially?
So great. So there are a few things here. So I think that the majority of what Newton... So if you read that article by Howard Cagle, actually the Nietzscheanism is pretty much reducible to what he draws from Clausewitz. Clausewitz is on war and a number of strategies regarding how you respond to war. Basically, for those who don't know Clausewitz, it's about de-escalation, right? So he's a Kantian about war. So he thinks that if you try and escalate, you're sort of going to go beyond the bounds of possible experience. That's broadly speaking what he thinks. And so de-escalation is the necessary response. So that's why guerrilla wars, pretty much all his war work. So that's why, the war, that Napoleon's war on the peninsula doesn't work. That's why the Zapatistas have done so well. It's why Afghanistan, States failed in Afghanistan and Vietnam. Right. So the reason why I think that Moton does a little bit more than Newton is, for one, Newton's contributions on this matter are fantastic, but brief in passing. A lot of the essay that I love, or the paragraph that I love, is kind of rehashings of Marcuse's lecture on utopia, which aren't exactly cutting edge today. The reason why I think that Nietzsche quote, why resistance isn't the eternal recurrence, and why acting out of, or rather even against time, is that to genuinely do the kind of action that Nietzsche is talking about in that essay, which is on the uses and abuses of history, because I read it, because it's really important for a curve. To actually do that, you require the representation of the falsity of your action against it. Because my point is that that if time is a transcendental condition on representation, which is a kind of Kantianism that I think you agree with, I reckon, right? Because insofar as time is something like a condition on capital and representation is equally indexed to capital, there's some, time functions as a kind of, as a condition on the possibility of representation. And as such, the action outside of time, insofar as it's always represented as such, will only ever actually work against it if it comprehends its own falsity. So it's again, it does return to this kind of negativity, but to the kind of negativity that I like. So the reason that Moton takes precedence over Newton really is his claim that such a negation can only ever really be represented, narratively speaking, in the kind of the history of a struggle for redemption. So that's the kind of nerdy philosophical answer. The simple kind of moral answer is the only way to act against what is to understand that you're part of it. And if you want to say that these are kind of self, you know, systems which exceed themselves, that means that the excess is still part of the system. And so it's that tension. That's the whole deal, right? So that escape, if it is part of the system, if the machine does work by breaking down, then the breaking down is equally part of it, which is probably a part of the point.
I mean, because this is the point of chapter two, which is basically letting control position is kissed on writ large. I mean, Labourism is control position is essentially the precondition of a typical dialectical view of control, which is it all feeds back in. Whereas creating stuff that doesn't feed back in, I think, is more important than ever, honestly, because, mostly because of the stuff you do in the book regarding the current state of the production of data.
Yeah.
Because where it's produced,
which is
mostly refugee camps. It's mostly every time you tap into something. It's my next book. The people in refugee camps end up either feeding data into machines which train the very things which hunt them down with their escape.
Yeah.
You know. But luckily, the people using them are all... Well, they're us, thank God. No, you're all idiots. So they
That's the lesson of these two books.
Both theory of transcendental stupidity of the angoid mind.
Yeah, that's right. I feel that we should probably approach wrapping up.
Yes.
Because I'm looking at it.
We've already done the Nietzsche spiel.
Have you got any closing, dramatic closing remarks, as you often do?
Dramatic closing remarks. Well, there's no narrative in this book, which I guess is kind of the complementarity aspect here of we hearing ourselves, or whilst there's hostility to dialectics in Antioculus, nonetheless, absolutely. I think in terms of zooming into the falsity of identity, you both share that in common. In terms of narrativizing certain things, I mean the Emmett Till example is a brilliant sort of it's a qualitative, but a quantitative measure.
Yeah.
And we're trying to provide a quite desensitized view of we see this horror all the time.
Yeah.
Eventually, at one point, it ticks over. And that's actually a genuine disagreement there in terms of are we just waiting for something to really light the fuse of hit our limit of the most horrible shit we can see every day?
Yeah.
Are we past that or not? I mean, that's a matter of incubation of movement, particularly. I mean, that's one of the benefits of the marches every Saturday. For Palestine it's an incubating scene for people who want to go to an occupation, people who will feel that sense of you're not insane. Everything in this country is lying to you, especially anything written down in the English language. I mean, it's the newspapers really are evil. Rupert Murdoch really is a cunt, who knows.
Well, I think that's probably a good place to finish. But
list people who are a cunt.
I think that's a great place. I think that you're absolutely right. I think that the commitment to the false, the commitment to nonetheless the thought of something outside of what already is, right? You know, that is absolutely shared. And while we might, I think definitely we do, and I don't want people to think that these two books don't disagree. I think they absolutely do, which is why it's
French by way of German, one for German by way of French.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. And I think there is a shared kind of political and philosophical project.
And one is endorsed by Etienne Ballard.